just settle in for some conversation on this Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride, and ahead on Juno Afternoon, the state made $30 billion under Angela Rodell's watch as director of the Permanent Fund Corporation. Now she's out. What's the impact of her departure? We're spicing things up for a Foodie Friday visit with Nimi Phillips, known in Juneau as the Spice Lady. She'll share one of her recipes that she cooks at her restaurant downtown. And shopping for that special someone who happens to be a techie, Dylan Samard from KMXT Radio will join us. We'll find out what's on his holiday wish list. And those are some of the conversations coming your way on Juneau Afternoon. In our forecast for the weekend, might be a little colder than you like, but at least you don't have to worry about rain. Look for widespread snow showers turning to scattered snow showers later on, with accumulations of 1 to 3 inches. Lows tonight in the upper 20s, accompanied by southeast winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. Now tomorrow and tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, isolated snow showers, turning colder with highs in the upper 20s, lows around 19 degrees. And by Sunday, your daytime highs will drop to 20 degrees, with lows dipping down from 6 to 14 degrees at night. Expect Monday to get even colder, highs from 13 to 18 degrees. Monday night, clear and cold with lows ranging from 2 to 8 degrees. Tuesday, things start to warm up again, highs in the lower 20s, lows from 12 to 18 degrees. And by Tuesday night, it'll be 10 degrees warmer compared to Monday. By Thursday, we see a warming trend with highs around 30 degrees and snow likely. And for tomorrow morning, the sun will rise at 8:35, set at 3:06. We are left with 6 hours and 30 minutes of daylight.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Tlinedi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on what were once tide lands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from their homes from these tide lands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and the future.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha ani kak gunish cheese.
And gunach cheese for being here with us today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. The Permanent Fund Corporation has had some record earnings during Angela Rodell's watch as director. She has been head of the corporation since 2015, and the value of the fund during her time grew by about $30 billion. But she is now out of the corporation. Its board of trustees removed her yesterday as CEO on a vote of 5-1. And although there had been some signs of tension recently between her and the board, her departure came as a surprise to many because of the remarkable performance of the fund. And joining me to give us some insights on this development and what might be the reasons behind this, Tim Bradner, a longtime business writer for Alaska, and he has a specialty in natural resource reporting. So I guess, Tim, maybe we should start out by talking about how Angela was regarded in the financial world. Was she considered at the top of her game?
Rhonda, Angela was very well regarded, as I understand it, certainly in the state's political community and in the Capitol building. She had been, you know, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, was highly respected.
Well, I mean, it has been remarkable, an incredible run. The fund has grown by $30 billion. I mean, that's quite a thing. Do you think that she should get the credit for that, or is that pretty much just the circumstances of the economic climate?
Rhonda, it's a little bit of everything in that. Obviously, the fund run-up happened because the whole financial market lifted, you know, caused the fund to gain in value substantially. A lot of the credit is due, frankly, to the trustees and the asset allocation formula that they put in place. A lot of it is due to the management of Angela Rodel and her staff, and the chief investment officer and the staff that that she works with there in Juneau. So I think it's not any one person should get the credit for this, but you know, face it, she was at the helm of the ship when this happened. The fund gained substantially in value, and I think she should get some of the credit for that. That's why it seems so odd that this happened.
Well, I guess odd too, in that there's really no explanation for it, and of course, it's the usual that this is a personnel matter, so we really can't discuss it. But do you think that the public is owed some kind of an explanation from the Board of Trustees?
Rhonda, I certainly do, and I think if there is no explanation forthcoming, I think it's going to lead to some losing of some of the public trust for the permanent fund. So I think there's a big responsibility for the trustees to step up to the plate and explain this thing, just the way it happened and why it happened. And I think the first up on the plate should be the chairman, Craig Richards. He should be the person that goes and explains this. And I know it's a personnel matter, and I know that usually those things are confidential, but in this case, there's so much at stake that if there's no explanation coming, it's going to start to erode public trust in the fund, in my opinion. And the fund has become so important to the state, paying, you know, 75% of our state budget, that this kind of goes beyond the normal rules. It has to be explained.
I know it's hard for people to kind of grasp that our budget, so much of it now comes from the permanent fund. And of course, you know, there has been some, I guess, controversy earlier in the year. She wanted to give her employees a bonus because they've done a remarkable job, and the Board of Trustees was not in favor of that. And as I understand it, they told her that the optics were not good since the governor since the legislature reduced the permanent fund dividend. It's not a big dividend, and that they thought it just didn't look good to do that. And so it's kind of interesting because it looks like maybe the permanent fund is being tied to the performance of the dividend somehow. And it's not supposed to kind of stand on its own in a formula.
Well, Rhonda, a lot of people don't know a lot about what the point of disagreement was between Angela and the trustees, particularly the Commissioner of Revenue, Lucinda Mahoney. She was on point on this, as I understand. Basically, as from what I understand, and you described it correctly, the fund's managers have performed very well, and they are the ones who should be given a lot of credit for the growth of the fund's value. And normally when a person does a good job, you give them a bonus. There's nothing really wrong with that. It's the idea is why they accept it. But in this case, the denial of a bonus because it doesn't look right politically is really doesn't quite square with the way things are normally done in professional financial service circumstances and compensation. It just doesn't look good to have political considerations like the size of the PFD and the optics of how things look when major decisions like this are made. It does look good, make us look very good in the financial community at large, and it shouldn't make us look very good in the state. it kind of makes us look small town.
Well, especially when you consider her stature, because she has a very compelling backstory. You know, aside from her service in the Parnell administration, she's a breast cancer survivor. And she's probably someone who could have stayed in New York City and had quite a career, make millions, and came to Alaska instead, and even took a big pay cut, I understand, to be here because she wants to be here. So what does that say about her departure?
Well, it tells me that the things are not managed on a very professional basis, is what it tells me. I think I have heard people comment that the permanent fund, the structure of its governance, and the fact that the majority of the members are appointed by the governor, so it gives it kind of a political flavor into it, could be done better. I mean, if a fund of this size could be managed in a more professional manner, the way big funds are managed down south, and the fact that we kind of do it our own way up here is not so wrong, but it just doesn't make us look very professional. I use the word small town. For example, we've always had a political brouhaha over the fact that the fund office is in Juneau, and we've kind of turned down the idea that the fund could have a satellite office in Anchorage, or that some of the key fund managers could live outside of Juneau. I mean, that's just really kind of a political decision that doesn't look very professional when it comes to kind of big money financial decisions and institutions like this.
So, Tim, what is your theory? Or, you know, I know you have lots of sources. I mean, what is it looking like? What's going on behind the scenes with this?
Well, probably the best interpretation, Rhonda, is the one that seems the most straightforward. I mean, who really knows what went on back behind the closed doors? And we hopefully we're going to find out. We should find out. Probably the most logical explanation of this is that Angela just got counter with the certain members of the trustees, you know, perhaps Commissioner Mahoney, over the bonus issue. Maybe there were some other issues. She got counter to them, and they won and she lost. That simple. That happens.
Well, some people are wondering about the timing of this, because we are coming up on the release of the governor's budget, and wonder if there's any connection in perhaps another dip into the reserves of the fund, maybe outside of what Angela Rodell would have thought would be good to take. I don't know.
Well, I don't think there's any connection with the budget, because the permanent fund's contribution to the budget for the operating portion is pretty well set. I think the governor got such a pushback, not only from the permanent fund trustees in Angela last year, but from the legislature on his idea of a double dip on the permanent fund, which some people called a raid on the permanent fund to pay a higher dividend. So I think that's probably off the table, I would think. And I think if the governor were to propose that again, particularly in the wake of the firing of Angela Rodell, mainly by trustees that he appointed, that wouldn't make him look very good. I don't think that's likely to happen.
Well, curiously, you bring up the governor, and you know, he was asked about that and said that he had nothing to do with this decision, that it's the trustees that make the decision, although he appoints them, but he has nothing to do with the decision. Do you think that's entirely true?
Oh, I think that's the case. I think he has to keep hands off of independent corporations like this. But still, you know, he does appoint them. Looking at the trustees, though, I think probably, you know, the only trustees that really answer to the governor closely are the commissioners that are on it. There were two other trustees that were appointed by Dunleavy. Craig Richards actually was Bill Walker's attorney general, and was actually, still is fairly close to Bill Walker. Steve Rieger was appointed by Dunleavy, but Steve was among the trustees before, under a prior governor. So I don't see this. It kind of has bad optics, so to speak. It looks like the governor could be pulling the strings behind the scenes, but in this case, I don't think it really is. I think it's probably just a matter of a fundamental difference of opinion between Angela and some of the trustees who happened to be the governor's appointees, and just was handled very poorly.
One of the things that we've always heard about the structure of the Permanent Fund Corporation is it's sort of a state agency, but it's got its own independence in a lot of ways with its board of trustees. Does it still have as much autonomy as it needs to have?
Well, it is autonomous in much the same way that the other independent state corporations like the Alaska Railroad or ADA, for example, or Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. In this case, the governor appoints the trustees of the permanent fund. The way that ADA has handled this, which is sort of interesting, is that they have made a decision to, and I think it took some legislation to do this, to have the majority of the directors of ADA be not appointed by the governor. There are governor appointees and commissioners on the ADA board, but the majority are not appointed by any particular governor. And that might be something that's worth looking at for the permanent fund too, so that there is not a majority of the trustees that would be appointed by any one governor during his term, which is the case now.
So a few more checks and balances might be in order. Well, one of the things that Angela Rodel said after that controversy involving the bonus is she herself mentioned the possibility of some kind of restructuring in which the corporation goes under the Department of Revenue. And I'm not sure I understand what that's all about. Can you explain what that possibility might be?
Well, I really can't think of what Angela may have had in mind. I mean, normally independent corporations administratively operate under a state agency. For example, ADA operates under the Department of Commerce, and so, you know, the budget goes through that department. It's within the framework of state government, although the permanent fund might have a different kind of structure. I don't really see a lot of, you know, what the advantages or disadvantages of that might be in this case.
So I guess going forward, you know, they're going to be searching for a new manager. They have an interim manager. And again, the permanent fund dividend and the permanent fund will be sort of a focus of the next session. And obviously, because it is a big portion of our budget now, what do you see on the horizon? What stories are you going to be looking at covering?
Well, we'll see the governor's budget and, you know, we'll see the permanent fund's contribution to the budget, which is pretty well set. It'd be about $3 billion, a little over $3 billion. And I think the really good thing about having this set up that way is that the legislature knows going in exactly what, you know, what kind of money from the permanent fund they're going to be able to get, which is set by the trustees, the prior year. That's not the case with oil revenue, which is now only a minority of the amount of revenue. That depends on oil prices. And the Department of Revenue makes an estimate of what oil revenue is going to be, but you never really know until later in the year. So having this kind of bedrock funding from the permanent fund to the state budget is really important because you know exactly what it's going to be. So that, you know, those sort of things are set in stone. I don't see the dividend becoming kind of issue that blocked up the whole legislature like it did in this current year's session. It's going to be an election year. Everybody's going to be running for re-election. There's going to be a lot of talk about a higher dividend, but I don't see the administration making a huge push like they did last year for it. I could be wrong.
Well, last year was the endless session, it seemed.
Well, I think everybody was so worn out by it. For one thing, the fight over the PFD really blocks the legislature from dealing with a lot of other issues that they have to deal with. You know, we had major education bills, you know, that were stalled up that should have passed, major fisheries, natural resources legislation, really important stuff. And everything sort of froze toward the end of the session because people were fighting about the PFD and they couldn't make up their mind about it.
Well, thank you for giving us a little glimmer of hope that we won't have a marathon series of sessions like we did last year. So thank you so much, Tim Bradner. He's a natural resource writer and also does a legislative report. that comes out. He's got his finger on the pulse of a lot of information. So thanks for kind of giving us your take on what happened, because it's so important to all of us. You know, we depend on the permanent fund for state funding now, and also for our individual dividends, our Christmas presents, so to speak, for many people. So thanks so much, Tim.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Rhonda. Take care.
Support comes from Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, providing Juneau with clothing for every occasion, bonfires, weddings, casual dinner parties, and more. Online at nuggetoutfitter.com or in person at the Mendenhall Mall.
This is Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for being here with us today. Our next guest is best known in Juneau as the Spice Lady, who has shared the secrets of spice in her cooking classes. And then she went on to buy the Saffron restaurant downtown and, of course, renamed it Spice. What other name would the Spice Lady give to her restaurant? Nimi Phillips is joining us now. Nimi, thank you for taking time out to get us in the festive spirit for the holidays. And I know you will be sharing a rice recipe later with us in the program. But, you know, first of all, let's talk about your latest incarnation as a restaurant owner. I believe you came to Juneau as an engineer, not to run a restaurant.
Thank you, Rhonda. Thank you for having me on the show. And yes, I worked as an electrical engineer and partner at Hayton Associates for the past 8 years. And for the past 2 years or so, I've been doing Indian cooking as auction dinners and cooking classes at my home. I always had the love for Indian cooking and flavors and, you know, old recipes and so on. So in June of this year, I got connected with Tracy and I decided to buy Saffron. And as of June 14th, I own the Saffron restaurant, rebranded and relaunched into Spice.
And of course, the name rings true. But because people, you know, you're famous for your cooking classes in Juneau. People just love the recipes that you shared with them and your knowledge of spices. So it seems very unusual, though, to open a business, to take a risk like that while we are in the midst of a pandemic, because a lot of businesses closed at that time. What made you decide to make the plunge?
You know, it's never a good time to start a restaurant, right? It's just, you know, you always think about, okay, this year might be the best, next year might be the best, but I just have to go ahead and do it. You know, 2020 COVID made you realize, is this what you want to do rest of your life kind of thoughts? And I always wanted to share my recipes and share Indian cooking with the rest of the world and thought, why not start now?
So tell us a little bit about where your family is from in India. And from what I understand, that India is a huge place and there are all kinds of different cooking styles.
Yes. India has 27 states as known. There's other regions that is not considered as states. And my family, my mom is from south part of India. And most of my cookings and recipes comes from my grandmother recipes and my mom's recipes and watching them, helping them in the kitchen since I was a young girl. And just to give you a perspective on different type of cookings in different parts of India, like we all make chicken tikka masala. It's called the same, looks the same, but the taste different. So every regional chicken tikka masala, for an example, is all different tasting, yet it's all amazingly yummy food. And what else can I say about different? I mean, again, garam masala. Garam masala is something that we all cook. We all have the recipes for it. It's all different from South India to North India to Kerala to Tamil Nadu. It's just different on different household, depending on which part of India, which regional you come from.
Well, of course, in this country, you know, we see southern cooking, which is known for its richness of the food, a lot of fat, a lot of sugar, a lot of salt. But everybody loves it. And also, you know, on the East Coast, you have Italian cooking. In Louisiana, you have also another very lush kind of cooking. So the southern part of India, where your family is from, what is the style of cooking there?
Southern India is mostly based, most of the cooking is based on coconut, because coconut is plenty grown there. And we have vegetarian, vegetable dish with coconut, meat with coconut, fish with coconut. And we have a lot of seafood. Seafood is another fish, different types of fishes. And that would be one of the things that South Indians do mostly. And, you know, even though India is a Hinduism country, we all blend in with the different recipes and cultural celebration and cooking and all sort of stuff. So even though most of my recipes come from South Indian, I also cook in, North Indian food as well. Learned from many friends.
Well, I guess that's kind of what makes it exciting, is that you can mm-hmm. bring recipes from different regions. So I understand that you're going to have the 12 days of Christmas celebrated in your menu. And I was kind of surprised, is Christmas celebrated in India? Is it much of a holiday?
Yes. You know, if south part of most of the south part of India, I would say 70% is just Catholics or Christianity. You know, it is a Hindu country, but it is celebrated equally, all the celebration, Diwali to Holi to Christmas. Everybody will have a star outside the window and all the church bells and carols. And even though you're a Hindu, you're still celebrated. I'm born and raised as a Catholic, and I still celebrate Diwali, Holi, and all the Hindu festivals. It's just it's a melting pot in India.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, that there's one region of India that has a large Catholic population. But mm-hmm. India mm-hmm. is such a different climate. You know, it's kind of like if you were in Arizona celebrating Christmas, you've got to have different traditions. So how is Christmas celebrated in southern India?
Christmas, same like here, just that we don't have snow. we have, you know, Christmas trees, like I said, stars, carols, group, you know, small groups of neighborhood carol singers go house to house, like old traditional style here. Special foods, mostly feast, amazing food. You know, what my memories from childhood comes is like, in the vacation time, we go to our grandparents' house, especially vacation time is Christmas time or any kind of holidays. And the memories that I have is the midnight mass, come home, amazing smell of yummy food made by grandmother. And, you know, that's what I want to bring to Juno. So the 12 days of Christmas dinner recipe, the appam, the chicken curry, the beef dry roast, those are all my grandmother's recipes that I want to bring to Juno and share with our amazing Juno.
So tell us about your grandmother. What was it like to watch her in the kitchen? And what did she teach you about cooking?
Mostly have fun with cooking. You know, even though she has her own way of doing, even though I make my own way of doing in front of her, she would not say, you're doing it wrong, do it this way. No, she'll say, have fun with it, make your own recipes. And, you know, you're sharing a food with the family, feeding another person is a way of my grandmother's life. And that's what's something I want to continue in my life.
So as you made your transition from being an engineer, and I'm sure in an office, that's probably a lot more sterile than a kitchen in terms of you know, workspace. How has it been for you?
It's been a lot of fun. I'm actually enjoying it. And I'm thinking, why didn't I do it 4 years ago or 5 years ago? And I'm not going to stop being an engineer. I always will be an engineer. And you know, this time in my life that I wanted to enjoy the most thing that makes me very happy with the restaurant is seeing the smiles on people's face, being a part of their special day, You know, just even if it's for an hour or two, it's just it makes a fulfillment or just a it's an amazing feeling.
So being an engineer and now running a restaurant, are there any disciplines or ways of thinking that carry over into your cooking?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What's that?
I plan things. As an engineer, you plan everything. Before you sit down to draw anything on a paper, you design the whole thing in your head. You have to have that imagination. And you do the same. I do the same thing in my kitchen. I imagine what it would be like, how many guests will come, or what are the plate, the platters going to look like, how pretty it need to be, what need to be changed. And everything you plan it in your head and you make perfect out of your imagination. Yes, it plays a big role.
Well, successful cooking is a matter of good planning, right? You got to have everything timed out perfectly and unless, especially if you're baking, boy, you know, you got to be very precise with your measurements of things. But I'm curious with Indian cooking, to me, most of what I know about Indian cooking, except for some of the few visits to Indian restaurants in various communities over the years, is what I see in the store. And more, you do notice more and more sauces, tikka masala sauces, curries, different spices being offered in the grocery store. But from what I understand, that's just kind of like the tip of the iceberg of all the flavors that are out there. So I know that you give 4-hour classes on the subject of Indian spices, but in a nutshell, what are the major spices? You mentioned that coconut is an important ingredient, but what are the key spices that define Indian cooking?
So I would say garam masala. Garam masala garam means warm in Hindi. It's a warm spice. The garam masala gives the life to any of your dish. So you've got to have garam masala in your pantry to do any type of Indian cooking, in my opinion. And, my garam masala, you can make any type of mixture of garam masala. There's so many different way of making it. Ours is cinnamon, mace, black peppercorn, coriander seeds, cumin seeds, cardamom pods, cloves, fenugreek, nutmeg. Those are all roasted as a whole spice, and you cool it down and you grind it, and that's how you get the garam masala. And like I said, everybody makes garam masala differently, and there's no right or wrong way. I would prefer to make your own house blend so that you can control the flavors and control the heat, control the, to specific needs of your dishes. So I would say garam masala is the life of every Indian dish.
So you hear a lot about curry, but what is curry? Is it really one spice or, what's in it?
Curry powder is made with the turmeric, cumin, and coriander. That's it. So the major part of the curry powder is turmeric. And, there might be other curry powders out there, but curry powder is not going to give you the flavors that you get from a garam masala. Garam masala, you can take and marinate your meat, fish, chicken, whatever, even vegetables, and leave it for 30 minutes. Then you put it into any type of coconut sauce, tomato sauce, any base of sauce, and you get an amazing intense flavor with so many different notes that you get on your taste buds.
I had a friend who was a vegetarian, and she would say, I can make you not miss meat. I promise you that if you eat my cooking, you will not miss meat because the flavors are so amazing. The spices in Indian cooking, are what I use. And also she cooked quite a bit of Thai food, which uses similar spices. But what is it about the use of spices in Indian cooking that makes you not miss meat, so to speak?
The Indian country as a whole is mostly vegetarians and eat a lot of seafood too. And there's, I can go on for, like you said, 4 hours to more about spices. And we got to do one one of these Juno afternoons alone on spices to, for me to cover this. But just in a nutshell, you know, like I said, Indian Hinduism culture has so many levels of tiers in just Hinduism. And most of the people in Hinduism, they are changing now, but they don't eat meat. Some tiers don't eat fish. So we had to come up with recipes that, you know, still gives you the proteins, the flavors, the fulfillment of your meal. And that's where all of these different flavors, and we're still learning more about flavors. And like I said, all what I know is so mustard seed of what's out there. So there's a lot more to learn.
See, you even use spice metaphors, a mustard seed, a tiny mustard seed. So what's your favorite spice?
Cardamom.
And why?
Cardamom is my favorite spice because it has the intense sweet flavor, and it can be used for a dessert, can be used to flavor your rice. It can be used in a meat dish, a fish dish. It can be used in so many different ways. And, you know, once you peel the outer layer of cardamom, the small seeds, you grind them. You can use it in smoothies. You can use it in any type of chai, latte, any of this stuff. And cardamom smells amazing, and it has so many different you know, benefits in to change the flavors on different foods and so on. There's two types of cardamom, green cardamom and black cardamom, and most of the cardamom that we use is green, and that's grown easily in south part of India.
So before we go, we have promised folks a recipe of yours, one of your favorite recipes for the holidays. And I promise that once I get off the air, that I will post it on our KTOO Juno Afternoon webpage so that you can download that. So you don't have to sit here or scramble for a pencil to get this recipe. But thank you for sharing one of your favorite recipes with us, and maybe tell us some of the memories associated with this recipe.
Absolutely. Before we go to that, I'd like to add one other thing to one of your questions, that how easy it was from going from engineering to a restaurant owner. I couldn't have done it without a great team that I have at our restaurant that came with my team came with the Saffron restaurant, amazing people. I couldn't have done it myself. That's one of the main reasons that it was an easy transition to a restaurant owner. Going to a recipe for the Kerala fried rice recipes, what I'm sharing today. And we used this fried rice recipe during our Diwali festival, and people loved it. Everyone loved it. The color, it's colorful. You know, for me, it's you look at something and it has to look pretty to make it, you know, more attracting. And it has French cut beans. It has string carrots, red onions, ginger, garlic, of course, garam masala, turmeric powder, and so on. So you first, when you make the rice, if you're making it in a pressure cooker, you add the basmati rice, cardamom, 6 cardamoms, 5 cloves, bay leaves 2, cinnamon sticks 2, and this is for 2 cups of rice. So you will get to serve for 6 people, 6 or more, depending how much rice you eat. So you put it in the pressure cooker together and you cook it. Once the rice is cooked, you can remove all the whole spices out of it. It leaves the rice with an amazing flavorful smell that will fill your kitchen with. And once you have the rice done, you can heat up the oil, you saute the ginger garlic, and then you add the red onions, cook that to a brown color, and then you add the French cut beans, string carrots, and cook that to make it, I would say, soft, not mushy. And then you add your garam masala and your turmeric, and you add the cooked rice to it, mix well, and then you garnish it with fried red onion and roasted raisins and cashews. And the recipe is, you'll put it on the web for everyone, correct?
Yeah. Right, because they can't write all that. They can't keep up.
I know, I was trying to keep it in the time limit, so I was saying pretty fast.
Well, the other thing too is you said pressure cooker, but could you use a rice cooker?
A rice cooker? Yeah. That's what I meant. Sorry.
So
rice
wow.
cooker.
Yeah. So the rice cooker will help people that have trouble making rice by the old-fashioned way of boiling it and all of that. So very quickly here, can you give us a memory associated with this dish?
Yes. Yeah. This actually, it's my aunt's recipe. My aunt makes this. She makes it so easily. She'll say, oh, I'll just make a fried rice today. And to me, always, it's amazed me how easy it was for her. And she didn't get the frozen French cut beans at the store. She actually French cut the beans by herself and the carrots, the string carrots. At least for us, we get them frozen and it's fresh and frozen. It's easily get to it and make a recipe quickly. But for her, it was cutting and slicing and, you know, putting all of this together. And she did not use a rice cooker. She boiled the rice. She boiled the rice in hot water, and that's how she cooked it. But she was able to make this in a small amount of time and I'll also have fun at the same time.
Well, it sounds like it'll be beautiful and colorful, and everybody will be really impressed when you set it on the table.
It is beautiful.
Very festive. Well, thank you so much for being here with us and talking about some of the essence of good cooking. And Nimi Phillips, Juno's very own spice lady and owner of Spice Restaurant. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Wildlife. On a summer day, a Sitka black-tailed deer is feeding beside the road. This buck sports a growing set of antlers in velvet. In spring and summer, the growing antler has a complex network of veins and arteries in the marrow of the developing bone. The skin covering the growing antler is called velvet and has nerves and hair and oil glands. The growing antler feels warm to the touch, and the deer would feel you if you were touching it. A young male deer gets a surge of testosterone his first summer that causes the growth of two bony bumps called pedicles, which will become the platform for future antlers. The first fall, small buttons develop, but it's not until the next summer that the first recognizable antlers form, small spikes. Antler size depends on genetics, nutrition, and the health of the deer, and its age. A young buck 2 years old is still growing its skeleton, but once it's full grown, the nutrients that went to the bone growth are transferred to the antlers. Antlers are not horns. Deer, moose, elk, and caribou have antlers. Sheep and goats have horns. Horns have a bony core covered with keratin, the same protein that hooves, claws, and fingernails are made of. Horns are not shed, and if they're cut off, they don't grow back. Antlers are shed in the winter and are regrown the following year. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
Afternoon programming is made possible by Royal Caribbean Group, the parent company of Celebrity Cruises, Royal Caribbean International, and Silver Sea. Together with Alaskan cruise destinations, forging long-term partnerships to support community needs. More at RoyalCaribbeanGroup.com.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Dylan Simard, a reporter at KMXT by day and by night, he immerses himself in the world of technology. An Xbox king, I hear, and somebody I always call up when I'm shopping for some kind of gadget or another. Hey, Dylan, how are you doing these days?
Fantastic. How about yourself, Rhonda?
Well, I'm really excited that you're going to give us the lowdown on holiday shopping for techies. But I guess from what I understand, that it might be hard to get some items right by this time.
That's correct. So, of course, everyone's familiar with the shipping delays that have been all over the country, right? I mean, I'm sure that many of your listeners are going to be used to having gone into Safeway, another major grocery store, and seeing, you know, maybe some products are in, some products aren't. It's kind of hit or miss. And of course, this is reflected out perhaps even more so into the world of consumer electronics. Not only do you have these shipping delays, but on top of that, there's a scarcity in a particular component, a microprocessor. And as the demand for consumer electronics has gone up, the availability of these components has gotten scarcer and scarcer. This has had an impact on the price of cars. I mean, I'm not buying anybody a car for Christmas, but perhaps if you were trying to do that, then no, that's a little outside the budget. But perhaps if some people were looking to do so, I mean, they may have seen that the price of used cars is way up and new cars is way up. And this has to do with the fact that these computer components that go into cars are very hard to come by now. Perhaps the biggest area that you can find this translated to is video game consoles, actually, like the Xbox Series X specifically, the PlayStation 5, and then the new OLED Nintendo Switch, all of which have graphics processing units in them, which are components that, you know, make the games look good and make the lighting effects and the explosion stuff look, make all those things look great. But they require a lot of the microprocessors. And then on top of that, you have the shipping delay, the unavailability of microprocessors, and then you're competing with people who are trying to get those components, GPUs specifically, for cryptocurrency mining. So you have a huge, like, you're competing with people who are willing to spend any amount of money to get these. And then you have scalpers who are using robots to pull the graphics cards or the consoles themselves off of the different retailers' online marketplaces. And at which point, when it finally gets down to, you know, John Doe, the regular consumer, you don't have a prayer. I mean, you'll just never get them.
So it sounds like if you should be making other plans to buy things for your teenagers. What is out there that's doable?
So actually it's not like literally impossible to get a console. It's mostly impossible, but there's been some recent reporting on how people have made these like influencer networks to like, you have like a micro celebrity who's running a Facebook page with like 13,000 of the most dedicated parents in the United States who are all like constantly refreshing Walmart. And you'll have this one person who goes, "Hey, Xbox Series X's are back in stock on Walmart in Germany," and then people will pay and like do currency exchange and any number of crazy things in order to get those consoles shipped to them in the US. But as for things that where it's not outside of the realm of possibility to get, there are all sorts of, one of the ways that I've been cheating lately, it is really hard to get these components.
You've been cheating?
Very funny, Rhonda. So
okay, go. I interrupted. So one of the things that you've discovered is...
Right. So one of the ways that people have been jumping over this shortage is that I'm a big fan of, there's an Xbox system. It's there's sort of been this discussion over who would come in and become like the Netflix of video games. And Xbox is kind of fulfilling that niche right now. They have this program called Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, which combines a subscription-based service for all these different video games together, and Xbox Live, which allows you to play games with other people. And then on top of that, it combines access to this network of computers, like these huge server bases that have games preloaded onto them. And basically the same way that like YouTube works, you're getting a video feed. It's the same thing, but it's taking in your input, like with a controller playing the video game, and you're streaming the video game. So you don't have any of the hardware. All you need is a screen and a sufficiently fast internet connection, and you can play any Xbox game anywhere you are. You can do it on Android phones now, in fact.
So in other words, more and more of what we considered hardware in the past is now to be found online. That's an interesting transition.
I do wonder if we're going to hit a point in the near future where phones are going to have a precipitous drop in processing power and most of it is actually going to be done remotely. But that's neither here nor there. So what I'm talking about is this service, Game Pass Ultimate, that's like about, I think it's $14.99 a month. And you could get that. You'd be able to play video games on a phone, tablet, any sort of like portable computer. And on older versions of the consoles themselves, as it were. And another sort of gadget that you could get to plug into this is there's a really, really good controller that you can just plug onto a phone. It's called the Razer Kishi. That's like $45. And it basically turns any sort of phone into, it has like, you know, the same joysticks and the button system as like an Xbox controller, and boom, there you have it. You're playing Xbox games wherever you are.
Oh my goodness. You know, heaven forbid that we have a moment of quiet and peace to read a book. But, you know, just real quickly, we got a couple of minutes left. What are some small stocking stuffer kinds of things that you would like to get in your stocking, Dylan?
They're not on the cheaper end of things, but sure, there are some. The Sony WF-1000X M4s, those are kind of the reigning king as far as headphones that are just in a case, sort of AirPod style. Excellent sound quality. They fit very well. There are a few other contenders in that category. I've been considering getting a pair of Galaxy Buds Pro. I am a working reporter, and those headphones right now have just about the best in class microphones you can get for recording a call. I mean, they really can't be beat. Another sort of thing that I was looking at, but I've seen like zero availability, was the UE Fits, which are these cool little headphones where you put them in your ear, and then for a minute it shines this UV light and it changes like the shape of the insert that goes into your ear canal, and it just perfectly matches your ear.
Wow.
It's kind of freaky. It's a little science fiction.
It does sound like sci-fi. My goodness. An ultraviolet shrinking earbud. Huh.
Yeah, basically. And apparently they're super comfortable, but people are having a really hard time getting those from what I can tell. Another thing I want to mention were certain items, like I'm a big Kindle reader, and I should have prefaced this sort of discussion about tech gifts with, you could always get somebody like a book or a Sudoku puzzle, but if it just can't be helped, then, you know, Kindle Paperwhites are like $139.99 right now on Amazon. That's a pretty good deal. And then there's another little stocking stuffer, the Tile Mate. That's a little square. It's about, oh shoot, smaller than like an AirPods case with about maybe a third of the depth. And one of those, you can just plug it onto your wallet or in keys, and you can use your phone to track it.
All right.
You know where it is.
Boy, I should get one of those. I'm always misplacing my keys. Well, I knew we'd get some good ideas from you, Dylan. So thank you so much for giving us some of your good ideas for the holiday season. Thank you.
Certainly.
All right. Thanks. We're talking with Dylan Simard. He's a reporter at KMXT in Kodiak and my go-to person to find out what new piece of technology I should buy. Thanks, Dylan.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klinkit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And that will do it for Juno Afternoon. Everyone have a great weekend.